Welcome to CL Talk, the leading podcast for the legal profession across Canada, brought to you by Canadian Lawyer Magazine. I'm Tim Wilver, the managing editor of Canadian Lawyer Magazine. Today, I'm speaking with Jennifer King, who is the national co-lead of the Administrative Law Practice Group at Gowling WLG. King was also recognized as one of the top 25 most influential lawyers in 2023. Just a reminder for our listeners that nominations for the top 25 most influential lawyers of 2024 is open now, and the deadline is April 19th to nominate. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
So I know the announcement went out last year, so it's been a while since you were recognized as the top 25 most influential lawyer, but can you tell me a bit about how it felt when you were when you heard about that you'd won this recognition?
Well, I was honored to be nominated in the first place and honored to win the award. When I heard about it, I really felt that I was nominated because of a real team effort, I believe, with the injunction with respect to the Ambassador Bridge. And that was a team effort, not just within the firm, but also really with the client and involving expertise outside of the legal field as well. So I feel like the nomination and the win was really recognized kind of a broader expertise and teamwork, and also just a lot of effort on a lot of different people, including mine.
Great. Well, we can get learn more about that in particular, that file that you had, as well as some of the other work that you've done. So let's get into learning a bit about your practice and accomplishments that helped you win this recognition. So first off, I know you work in administrative law and you also specialize in climate change and ESG. So can you tell me a bit about how your role has evolved at your firm?
Well, interesting. So I started off as a general civil litigator, in fact. And when I came over to Gowling WLG in 2016, I specialized in environmental law, which would include at this point, maybe ESG and climate change as well. But it's interesting, moving from a generalized general practice in civil litigation to specializing in environmental was actually an expansion of my practice. So environmental law is a very interesting area of the law. And, you know, I expanded a bit outside of just litigation and solving disputes and resolving disputes, and moved into thinking about bigger issues of administrative and public law, for example, dealing with issues of regulation, municipal bylaws, engaging with brownfields, for example. So it really kind of expanded my practice and my approach outside of to kind of expanding outside of litigation. So over the years, working in environmental law, the issue of ESG, or environmental, social, and governance, really started to be discussed among lawyers, like I'd say around 2018, 2019, and kind of came out of the investment area. And a lot of environmental lawyers, if you ask them about it at the time, would say, well, these are issues that we've been dealing with in our practice the whole time we've been practicing, dealing with regulation around environmental issues and litigation around risk and environmental risk. It's kind of our bread and butter. But, you know, since 2018, 2019, a lot of law firms, including ours, has an ESG practice group. And it really is developing into a really interesting area of cooperation, really, within the law. You don't have ESG lawyers. We have ESG regulation and risk being considered kind of in every area of law. And we can really see this in a proliferation of regulation around climate change and ESG today.
Great. I want to ask a bit more about some of the files you've worked on in this area, but your role as the head of administrative law group at Gowling and how that works. I know you said ESG isn't really a kind of lawyer, but it's a kind of regulation. So how did that grow your role within the firm when you took on that leadership role?
Okay. So I think a few years ago, I got involved in the ESG group. And, you know, when we think about ESG and trying to define what it is, it's an interesting question. And in fact, a few years ago, Osgoode CPD started an ESG climate risk and the law course to kind of try to get into the question that you're asking here. And I've just recently taken over as program director for that certificate program with Osgoode PD. And it's not just one piece of regulation, it's many. And it's also kind of voluntary standards for disclosure. And what we're seeing is a move from voluntary disclosure to more mandatory requirements for disclosure around ESG issues, including modern slavery and GHG emissions, for example. And so when I think about that, and I think about the regulation, when we think about administrative law or public law, all that regulation, the kind of the government's relationship with citizens, is all, it's administrative and public law. So administrative and public law is kind of a broad category that covers really that relationship between the governed and the governors, like the, and the government. So right. In the last year, I've taken over the co-lead role for the administrative and public law group at Jowling.
Great. And in you mentioned that you work on the Ambassador Bridge, and yes. I know that was something that was part of your recognition last year, because the Talk 25 is often a recognition of recent work that a lawyer has done. So that was one of the noteworthy files you'd worked on. So talked a bit about it already, but can you tell me about how that came about and how that file landed on your lap?
No, that's a good question too. So interesting. These emergency, there's been a lot of emergency issues that have come up in the last few years around the pandemic. And, you know, this issue of the protests and the blockade of the Ambassador Bridge kind of raises a number of issues in different areas of law. So, you know, how this landed in my lap is a good question, but I'd done some work for Windsor in the past, kind of in the areas of administrative and municipal law. And in the case of the Ambassador Bridge injunction, that injunction was partly kind of a traditional injunction, but ultimately was a municipal injunction. So kind of a statutory injunction under like that's specifically available to enforce municipal bylaws. So this partly had to do with my experience with municipal law and understanding of that role. But it's also, I think, kind of it was a unique injunction in the sense that, you know, I'm representing a local level of government. That at the same time as in making sure that they're enforcing their bylaws and protecting this major piece of critical infrastructure, also has to balance the rights of the protesters. So, you know, I think that the challenge was to represent a local government with that level of, you know, balancing these really important considerations. And so it's just a matter of having, you know, done different work for municipalities in the past. And, you know, I think that at least I pride myself in having an approach where I'm working with the clients and making sure that, you know, I understood this wasn't just a legal issue, right? This was a, you know, major political issue and involved, you know, the police, which even the Windsor police and other levels of government, you know, that's something where the municipality can't direct what the police do. So what was it that the municipality could do while balancing those rights of the protesters? So, you know, there were a lot of different pieces to consider there. And so the other piece of it, too, is that I have also some background in kind of understanding these interjurisdictional issues between the interjurisdictional issues and then also the need for cooperation between different levels of government. So that's something that as municipal and environmental lawyers, we actually deal with quite a bit. You know, in law school, I think a lot of lawyers think you're talking about the Constitution, you're going to talk about the Charter. As environmental lawyers, we deal with federalism issues all the time. And that became a major issue with the protests and ultimately was an important theme, I think, in the commission's report.
Great. And I'd imagine it was because it was so high profile that this was, you know, a stressful file. There was a lot going on, so multifaceted, it sounds like, all the different stakeholders and areas of law. So now that it's sort of over with, I guess, or maybe there's more work you're doing on it, can you reflect about how that going through that kind of experience maybe was formative in your legal career?
It certainly was formative for a number of reasons, including this was a hearing that was done virtually. It was, you know, still during some pandemic restrictions and it had to be done very quickly. So, you know, as lawyers, we have to, I believe, we have to kind of be there with our clients. These emergencies don't happen on a timeline. They don't happen on a Monday when you come into work. That's true for the lawyers, but it's also true for all the people that we're working with on something like this. And so what I found, you know, about this issue and about this, these circumstances, the circumstance, the protests and the blockade was that all of the people involved, including the legal team, were there when the issue needed to be resolved, when the issue had to be addressed, when we needed to be in court. People were there. The affiants, the staff at the city who had to post notice of the injunction. This is something they hadn't done before. So, you know, even just printing off the big forms of the injunction and putting them up and down the street to ensure that protesters had clear notice of the injunction. So, I think that, and that part of the reason why I'm talking about this, I think that when you end up looking at the commission's report on the Public Order Emergency Commission, there was a big emphasis on the need for collaboration and cooperation. Again, not a problem that can be solved just by the courts. It has to involve the cooperation, coordination of all. And so in a way, even though it was challenging, it was also quite satisfying, because in the case of the team, the legal team and the other teams in Windsor, there was a lot of collaboration to deal with a very important issue.
Well, that's great. I could keep asking questions about this file, but I want to talk about some broader issues too. So, you know, you work in ESG, you work in corporate governance. These are high profile issues too on a policy level. So what are the big trends you're seeing in ESG and corporate governance, that, or where do you see these issues going sort of as the law evolves?
There's a lot going on this year, Tim. So I expect we're going to see a lot this year. So I think we started the ESG practice group. The leadership team was 2018, 2019. And at the time, we were saying and advising that even though there isn't mandatory reporting with respect to, I mean, really the focus was first on climate change. Companies, corporations had to think ahead and to see that there's a lot of pressure from stakeholders and investors to have disclosure and to carefully consider the non-mandatory disclosure standards and really try to ensure that you have the data and that you're disclosing even before it becomes mandatory, because the trend is towards mandatory disclosure. Since then, we've seen mandatory disclosure, for example, the SEC in the States currently under litigation, but finally issued those. And in Canada, we've been waiting for mandatory disclosure for several years now, that has been essentially waiting for what's going on in the States. So what we see happening this year is mandatory disclosure with respect to modern slavery. We also see some with respect to some banks. So we're seeing it happening, right? So we're going to actually see some more mandatory disclosure in Canada. And then what we're seeing is just a real increase in litigation. So a few years ago, again, when we first started really looking at this, there was a lot of reports about the kinds of climate change litigation against governments, saying governments, your standards aren't stringent enough, and this is harmful on the rights of youth and others. And so we saw in Canada kind of an increase of that kind of litigation following the footsteps of what's happening abroad and in Europe. And so we're seeing more of that. We're now seeing that kind of strategic climate litigation increasingly against corporations, and that corporate standards are not high enough. We're seeing that in Europe. I anticipate we're going to see more of that in Canada. And really what you might have heard a lot in the last couple of years is about greenwashing claims. So we're seeing more investigations by agencies across the world, including Canada, that are investigating greenwashing and other kind of claims, and some more investigation enforcement. And then we're seeing the class actions and the litigation kind of coming out of that. I'm thinking that as we start to see actual mandatory disclosure, we're going to get more information. We're going to get more information about practices and data from corporations than we've had before. So perhaps there'll be some more litigation coming out of that. We'll see. And then another thing that we're seeing is, so we've got the mandatory disclosure with respect to corporations, and we're also seeing public bodies disclosing their own ESG GHG emissions and coming up with their own targets to meet net zero.
Great. And there's so much going on. It sounds like there's just it's a growing area, I would say. I mean, I know there's, not so much in Canada, but in the US, there's controversy around ESG and that kind of thing. But, you know, whether it's controversial or not, lawyers will be busy advising their clients in this area. So, I think this is an area that a lot of young lawyers are really interested in because it's so, it's so in the public realm. So what advice would you give to lawyers who young lawyers who might be interested in developing a practice in whether it's administrative law, ESG, or climate change?
So I think that it's useful for learning lawyers to, like what I did is that I talked to people both who had practices that were interesting to me and then also the lawyers who seemed happy and were working in areas that were interesting to me. One of the great things about being a lawyer is that especially if I'm predominantly a litigator, although I work in advice and give regulatory advice in other areas as well. As a litigator, you can pick up a case where you spend a year worrying about and thinking about machining brake arms, right? Like you can really dig into topics. And so I would say to a young lawyer to, work on cases that you are passionate about, but you can find, a lot of interest in kind of any case that you're on, big or small. And so, to really dig in and to learn those skills so that when a case comes along that might raise kind of existential threats, like you're dealing with, I was on the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act reference a few years ago. So then you have the skills to actually take that case. And in that case, me and some of my colleagues were involved for an intervener on the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act reference. I think that for young lawyers, pick areas that you're passionate about, that you are, engaged in, where you can meet your clients and kind of perhaps even be more engaged and passionate about their clients' issues than theirs. And maybe I'm rambling around a little bit. And then just talk to the lawyers who are doing the kinds of work that you want to be doing in 10 years and who seem really excited about doing it, and ask them how they got there. And in my case, I really have in many ways kind of followed I find cases whether they're small or big, if there's things that are really important or a real problem for my client, then I get as passionate about it as them. And it's kind of that excitement, kind of, getting engaged in it, the level of your clients, that really I think can drive an exciting practice. I think becoming an ESG lawyer, sitting here today, I don't know if that's a practice on its own. So Tim, what we're seeing is procurement legislation or rules, or protocols, policies that are encouraging that, for example, the federal government has a procurement policy where if, certain procurements over a certain amount, you have to make sure that you're considering net zero commitments of bidders. So that's a procurement lawyer who now has to worry about policies and regulations that engage with ESG issues. And so this ESG is really an area of the law where it's touching on, like any lawyer who deals with kind of regulated industries or regulation, we're seeing ESG kind of being incorporated across legislation, not just, we don't see an ESG legislation. It's kind of incorporated into many different areas of law. So I don't know if that quite answers it, but ESG really requires collaboration across different practice areas.
Yeah, well, I definitely think you answered a lot of questions young lawyers would have, like the fact that, as you say, there's not an ESG lawyer out there, but there are many elements within ESG that require, really deep legal knowledge and it's multifaceted. So I think that's fair. That's a great message to leave our listeners, our young lawyers, listeners, at least to in mind if they're interested in this area. And congratulations again on your recognition. And
thank you
for speaking with us today. And again, a reminder to our listeners to nominate the next crop of accomplished lawyers for the top 25 most influential this year. And we look forward to hearing more about your career and all the interesting cases you're working on.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CL Talk. You can listen to the latest episodes on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, and all major listening channels. Just search for CL Talk.